Thank you, Corey. That was a very insightful, thorough presentation. Our next speaker is Austin Brister, one of my law partners with McGinnis Lockridge. He's going to be speaking for the next 30 minutes on COPUS accounting procedures. So hopefully he'll make it entertaining. If not, grab a cup of coffee.
Well, thanks for having me here. I noticed the room was very empty, and then right when the COPUS presentation started, like everyone's piling in here, they're just really wanting that COPUS talk, so I'll see if I can do that justice. I used to give Jonathan a hard time for his COPUS papers and talks as something that you can't make interesting, and now here I am, so I guess that's my payback. So we're going to talk about COPUS, of course, and I think COPUS could easily cover half a day, full day, just talking about the legal issues. Well, I have 30 minutes, and so what I want to focus on is primarily just going through some potential conclusions you can raise through case law, mostly through a multi-jurisdictional kind of look. There's really not that great of a breadth of case law on the COPUS directly. COPUS is often kind of indirectly involved in disputes between operators and non-operators, but not quite as much a direct. There's not as much case law where parties are just directly focusing on the COPUS to the point that it's in a lot of cases. So it's going to be a presentation where we go through some of those cases and try to draw a body of potential conclusions you could raise. So first starting out, the COPUS organization is pretty incredible. They're pretty active. They have a lot of things beyond just the COPUS form, right? They have their accounting guidelines that they publish. They also have their model form interpretations. It's pretty interesting. If you go to their website, look at all the things they have. It's pretty remarkable. To what extent that those other publications matter or not when you're in a lawsuit trying to interpret the COPUS form is potentially up as a potential dispute topic we'll get to. Those AGs, the accounting guidelines, that's another thing they publish. They try to provide guidance on things that are not directly covered by the model forms. The model form interpretations, as the name suggests, tries to provide some guidance on how to interpret and also how to imply how to apply the COPUS in practice. But we're going to mostly be talking about the COPUS form. COPUS form, first published in 1962. Over the years, they updated it several times. 84 is perhaps one of the most common versions that are out there. They then made another revision in 2005. Those are the two most common forms. That's mostly what I'm going to be talking about today and drawing some distinctions between. That went rather quick. So first of all, how do we interpret the COPUS form? Well, I think it's important to note that the COPUS at the end of the day is a contract. It's attached to the back of your joint operating agreement. So there's not a whole lot of magic on how you interpret the COPUS in general. As Texas courts generally hold frequently. I mean, if it's an unambiguous document, you're going to look at the four corners, determine the party's intent, apply the language in its plain meaning unless they use it in a technical sense and so on, and not looking at extrinsic evidence. If it's ambiguous, maybe we let extrinsic evidence in, maybe we look at anti-harmonizing canons, right? Not a lot of real specific stuff to cover on that, and so I'm going to generally skip over some of that stuff and not try to reinvent the wheel there. Again, I think there's pretty sparse case law. So why is that? I try to think, okay, why is it that there's so few cases specifically discussing the COPUS? And I think that the reason is primarily because the COPUS is an accounting document that has that audit procedure in there where there's what they call like a ping pong back and forth. Parties have deadlines where they're supposed to be negotiating back and forth. And if they do that, great. If they don't, there can be some penalties that they suffer because of it. And so for that, they end up kind of negotiating a lot of those things out. A lot of those things work themselves out. You also have those accounting guidelines, model form interpretations. While they might ultimately not be admissible in a trial, are they helpful to resolving accounting audits and disputes? Probably very much so, yes. Also, again, the accountants and the auditors are pretty active in COPUS, suggesting that they take the audits quite seriously, so that weeds out a lot of those disputes beforehand. So, the case law we do have, again, multi-jurisdictional approach to this so that we can try to gather together a body of case law that that can help us analyze this, really kind of boils down to two things that we're going to talk about mostly when it's the bread and butter COPUS that we're looking at. First is the scope of what the adjustment provision applies to. We're going to talk about that quite a bit, but that's the contractual limitation provision that bars disputes over joint interest billings 24 months after the end of the calendar year, unless there's a sufficient written exception made. So that's the second category of what we're going to talk about, is the sufficiency of that written exception.